Hi, viewers. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Lightning Bolt Leadership. We have myself, Xavier Vergara, and John Craig interviewing Dr. George Banks, who is an applied social scientist who has worked on designing and implementing platforms for education, community, racial differences, gender, and leadership. He has an application titled From the Inalienable Rights to the Inalienable Challenge, America's Pursuit of the Fulfillment of Freedom. He has had successful projects around the country, which he will discuss today, and he is also an adjunct at George Mason. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. George Banks.
Oh, thank you very much, Xavier, for having me here. I'm honored to be here to share with you and your audience. Thank you very much.
And today we will start off. I'm curious to know about your project in Boston that in the Boston area that you have discussed with me previously. Could you elaborate more on what you did to help to improve the community there in Boston?
Okay, yeah, I can give you some breakout of that. I think would be helpful, and again, this depends on how you want to proceed, is to give you a sense of the underlying approach that I represent. And I think as I do that, then as we look at particular activities, projects, what have you, issues, questions, then we have a reference point. So I could just take a couple of minutes just to kind of lay that out for you, not to take over the interview or anything like that, but just to give you an overview. I'll come back to getting over some late spring allergy here, so I apologize. The overall theme that is the focus for what I'm involved in, I have labeled it as an emerging perspective in terms of from the inalienable rights to the inalienable challenge, America's pursuit of the fulfillment of freedom. And I know this sounds a little lofty, up in the clouds, 30,000 feet, but I start there. And what I refer to is translatable to platforms and programs that we can implement. And there's a history of that and those with whom I've worked, and we anticipate moving further. But here's the situation. As we look around at our country and we look at this whole perspective of fulfilling freedom, our country and our communities, we're really being challenged significantly, and we're struggling. I'm not saying there aren't wonderful things going on, but we have major issues we're wrestling with, and at times, and this is not political, I'm not getting any political statements here, let me just be clear about that at the start. I'm just saying we're trying to find our way in very challenging times, and what that requires is us to get some perspective as to what we see, what we're doing to be about. So it's kind of like taking our view of America, taking our view of freedom to the next level. We're being challenged to elevate, to take it to the next level. Where do we go into these circumstances? So there's several pieces to this. One is just the overall theme, and then I got a couple other pieces that I'll share with you that support this overall theme, but I don't want to turn this into a lecture because you didn't bring me in here to lecture. You're not one of my students at Mason, so I'm trying to make this streamlined, but it'll help as we go along. So if you go to the title, Inalienable Rights, every American is entitled to the inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. We all have that. Now, I submit there's another very important consideration for us that really takes on significance now in these days that are very challenging for us as we begin to think about how do we resolve all these issues that just seem to be coming at us, and are we making progress or not? And that gets into the second part of my theme here, the inalienable rights and the inalienable challenge. And what I suggest is that, in addition to the rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we also have the freedom to think, to process information. Oh boy, that sounds real lofty, real general, and I can break it all down. I'm just giving you the highlights right now. But it's the freedom to think. In fact, that becomes a responsibility for leadership. Now, what do I mean by leadership? Let me just give you this real quick. My whole approach is focused on leadership, because I think that's where the responsibility comes from. So I have a view called a call for leadership. By leadership, I mean those who, regardless of their background, I don't care if their political background or high-level organizational background, whatever it is, their backgrounds, their circumstances, or position, seek to accept the inalienable challenge for self, others, and our country. That's a pretty strong challenge, all right? Now, the inalienable challenge includes taking responsibility for the freedom to think from the perspective of the high ground. And I'm hearkening all the way back to the Founding Fathers. The Founding Fathers launched us on our wonderful freedom challenge. We've had serious problems in terms of enslavement, and we're dealing with those issues, all kinds of issues. But that's the path we've put ourselves on. How do we elevate? How do we move in? How do we move forward? So to identify and implement the initiative needed to support America's pursuit of the fulfillment of freedom for all America. So those are the broad terms that I take. This is a call for leadership. Now, there are a lot of folks out there who said, we don't care. That's their freedom to choose not to care. We don't want that leadership. We want what we're entitled to. Fine. So all of what I'm saying here is based on the premises that I'm looking to work with. I and my colleagues are looking to work with those who are willing to take this responsibility. So I can articulate that more, but I don't know. I feel a need to stop as I'm talking a lot. So because you're here to interact, we're here to interact. I can add more to what I'm thinking, but it's a leadership perspective. So because we have a void. Now here's the other thing. Honest to goodness, I wouldn't be here talking with you. I wouldn't be teaching at George Mason. We have a direction. We have a direction. You talked about student loans and all that, the whole big issue. We can come back to that in the context. But we have a direction for addressing these issues. And the thing I'm trying to do is to get people to understand that there is a direction, because we're struggling. And it's not just racially, in terms of gender issues or what have you, income, all kinds of issues. We're struggling. But we have a direction that can end up meeting these needs and servicing communities and our overall country, our overall society. Anyway, I feel a need to hold back now a little bit as I get to rocking and rolling. So that's a starting point. I can tie back into it a little bit.
Absolutely. John, do you have any questions?
You're very patient, both of you. Thank you very much.
I love what you say about leadership, and that's a field of mine. Our show is Lightning about leadership, which I think, excellent. You know, we not only need leadership, but we need it pretty fast because things are pretty bad. And so I think that is a great starting point. And then the other thing is, I do come a lot out of the digital entrepreneurial world. And the ideas that you're putting forward are actually put out also by a top Silicon Valley leader that talks about the need to change society, and this is our priority here. And I think you have many ideas that parallel. It's kind of like calculus was invented in two or three places at once, you know, or the DNA was discovered in different places, because smart people go in the same direction quite often, even if they don't know each other. But I really agree with what you're talking about. But I wanted to tie it into the education that we were, educational topic, quality education, mm-hmm. you were talking about a little bit earlier, mm-hmm. because one of the digital gurus that comes out of Silicon Valley says, you know, the organizations of the future are going to be those that learn the fastest It's all about learning. We've got to learn from each other. We've got to create relationships, create community. And you mentioned these, you were talking about applied social sciences. I'm a social worker. I would bring together cardiac patients who want to quit smoking and get them to teach each other, inspire each other, create relationships that can help them through the questioning process to discover the solutions that they need right now in their lives. I just wanted to maybe you could head down that road, because you've talked about leadership and education, and how do we either educate leaders or lead educators, or combine these two things, learning, which is education, and leadership. Maybe you could go somewhere with that.
Okay, so what you're saying is how do we get there? How do we build with this emerging resource,
right,
to move toward that which we are seeking to have happen as a resource for our country? And again, at the risk of getting too involved, because, relatively speaking, we don't have a lot of time, so I'm just trying to hit highlights, but the key to all of this is what we talk about with leadership. So I talk about a group of leaders from all walks of life, however they identify themselves, and we begin to work with them. Now, here's the requirement. The requirement for them, the opportunity for them, is to begin to think like scientists. Now, does that mean they got to go out and get white cloaks and go set up an office in a laboratory? All the stereotype descriptions of scientists into the laboratory. And it's like what I was sharing to you a little bit before we got started. Here's the essence for the leadership. The essence is understanding that science is a thinking process. Now, in saying that, I'm not making it a generality. When I say applied social science, that means as a scientist, you have a responsibility to do what we call taking our key constructs, like thinking, and put them in operational terms, which are steps, like how to do. And then as that is provided, those steps are the basis of observing its implementation, measuring its implementation, but most importantly, delivering in the intent of the effort, which is to create ideas, all right? So we come to leadership, and it's like, how do we help them begin to think through, relate to phenomena, to represent them? I was talking to you about art before we started in online here. But how do we begin to create these images and these thinking skills? And we have one-dimensional, two-dimensional. Javier sat with me this spring semester, and we had two-dimensional representations of key constructs in human learning and development, motivation and engagement. And we got into that. Now, that's a thinking skill. So what that requires is for to capitalize on this wonderful resource that leaders potentially have, we've got to begin to expand their capacity to process information, to think as they are scientists. Now, this carries over not just to the leadership, but further on down the road. Now, here's the thing with digital technology, and I throw it out there, and it ties to education. We have an extraordinary influx of technology, extraordinary. And we see it in public schools, for example. Unbelievable. They got Promethean boards, and the kids are walking in with all their phones, and they're all wired up, and hey, marvelous education. And this is back to my point about re-examining assumptions about quality ed and how we begin to say, let's examine quality ed, because right now we have quantity ed as the actual reality of education. Now, what the assumption is, we put all this technology in, but we assume, the administrators, the leaders, that the presence of the technology will stimulate all kinds of thinking. No evidence. In fact, I'll take it a step further. Done a lot of work, a lot of analysis, looking at a lot of things going on, and there's not one study. Now, I'm not saying it's not out there. I've yet to find a study that shows that the introduction of that technology in these current circumstances actually leads to increased student learning via the learning process, thinking process, stimulated by the technology. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but hey, where's the data? Now, we've gone into schools minus the technology, and we've had students who are struggling with achievement. There were achievement gaps. And we'd go into U.S. history. We'd go into earth science. We'd go into algebra. And we would deliver to the students thinking skills. Not just say, hey, be smart. And we have bright kids, and we have some who are advanced placement and AP and all that. But actually thinking skills, all right? One-dimensional, two-dimensional, and going real fast. But we had to teach these skills first to the teachers because they came from their graduate education programs, and I'm not putting any college down. But nobody ever taught them the thinking skills. They read about metacognition, they read all these theories, but they never learned the skills. So they had to learn it and then teach it to the students. Then, within a half a year, as an example, we taught teachers in U.S. history the thinking skill to pass on to their students. The previous pass rate for the students at that grade level, grade 9, for that school district was like 25-30%, Virginia history. Within just half a semester, a half a year effort, the testing took place in the spring, the results, the achievement jumped to 59%. Can you claim cause and effect? No, you can't. All right? It's not a hard-nosed study. But the teachers, the administrators of the school, the students know, I learned a skill for relating to this information. All right? Now, backing it up to the adults, the quote leaders, a requirement for them is to say, oh, I've got something to learn about the thinking and learning process. So that now as they come together, they're not just being responsive to each other and accommodating to each other, but they actually have a work product coming out that can be implemented.
Yeah. I did have something to mention on that that I think a lot of people don't know about, and I was lucky enough to stumble upon. Now, it's not only that technology can't teach you certain things, and I know you already know what I'm about to say, but maybe not the depth of its power, is that technology can distract us to the point where we can't think anymore. And this is actually neuroscience, because there's actually a very young man. It's ironic again that this is a young man named Cal Newport who is over here at Georgetown University. He's already got tenure at age 35 in the computer science department. He studied at MIT. He knows computers. He will not use social media. And he has a rule, and he has a book called Deep Work. And Deep Work is when you shut down all distractions and you will not take a call. You put your phone in the freezer. And you practice, because practice makes perfect. Just like playing music, you practice thinking without distraction so that you can get deep into your work. And he says at that point, you're going to do your best work in terms of you love what you're doing because it's really good. It's going to be the best impact on society. On top of that, it's going to make you a better salary because what you're putting out is such high quality that people resonate to it. And it's tragedy. So back to your talk about students, because you know so much about the educational process in our country. You've got all this technology, but do they know how to shut the door and think their own thoughts through? Or talk about it. He says, you can either do it alone or get a best friend or a good colleague, because then your private conversation that's not interrupted by a video going over here and your friends calling you on the cell phone and you've got text messaging. Anyway, I just wanted to say that I think this is a vital part of what we got to do.
No, I think you're making a couple of points, John. First of all, you're talking about almost like the other extreme that we can go to, being so wrapped up in the technology that we begin to lose sight of some of the basic elements of relating, and that's a critical piece.
Yeah.
And the other point is that I'm not saying technology is bad.
I'm not either. Please. I think it's wonderful. I love it. I love it.
But if you think about it, putting it into the hands of the adult, the young person, who then has, as a context, the actual skill of thinking relating to information and creating representations or images to test out, then you're talking about a wonderful combination. Let me give you an example. I have to recognize, along the way, I've been most fortunate because I've had the benefit of dealing with, I consider to be the most outstanding social scientist ever. And he is one of the most cited in the psychological literature, social science scientists, and that's Dr. Robert Karkoff. And
how do you spell that, please?
C-A-R-K-H-U-F-F.
Okay, great. And where is he now? Or?
Oh, he's, you just Google him, you'll find him. He's all over the place. But the point is, he has created, among other things, an extraordinary foundation for human-centric information processing. This is a powerful context. So as I talk about leadership and I begin to talk about a unifying ideology, which I haven't even gotten a chance to talk about, there's a foundation there, and it's most powerful. And he and his colleagues right now are into the area of enterprise functioning, businesses, to demonstrate how productivity within the enterprise, the organization, incorporating technology, is significantly enhanced by the transmittal of human information processing strategies and programs to think as a context for utilizing this extraordinary technology. And his stuff is breaking and it'll be coming forth. So there's just so much for us to consider in terms of that. So that's my approach. Now, the other piece I want to add, I don't know how we're doing on time, and I'm rambling here, but... Okay, so we get to this whole idea of leadership, and what I talk about is equipping leadership with what I call a unifying ideology. Ideology is a collection of ideas and values. Now, as you begin to prepare the leadership with a framework for thinking, processing information systematically, their product, their outcome, is a framework of ideas and platforms and programs for implementing solutions to the issues that we face. All right, now, here's my fundamental basis. And I guess those two PowerPoints that I sent to you will be available at some point. But let me go back to the most significant relationship I think I've acquired over my experience. Obviously, I'm Black, African American, grew up in Boston, and familiar with the Boston Massacre, the work of Crispus Attucks, and first to die in the American Revolution, and that's in my blood. And as I came through school, I learned psychology and education, fully aware of the issues, the racial issues, that our country has been significantly involved in. And as I began to emerge into my professional work and I conducted some of my research and what have you, what became clear for me was a very powerful relationship. And I can show you the image here. We won't be able to show it to the audience, but it's this relationship here. And this is in my infographic book from the Fulfilling the Strength of Black America, Indeed All America, A Direction for Civil Rights. All right? We can go into any context, a school, community, workplace, neighborhood. And in that context, there are two elements. The first element that I've designated by this rectangle is effectiveness. The second element is that of problems and issues in any context. Now, here's the relationship that I have been able to uncover. In those settings or situations where we have low or declining levels of effectiveness that we can assess through operational definitions. So, for example, we looked at many, many, many teachers. And we found teachers who were helpful, white teachers with black students, white teachers with white students. And we found white teachers who weren't helpful with black students, who weren't helpful with white students. And we found many black teachers who were helpful with black students and not helpful with black students. Many black teachers who were helpful with white students, helpful with black students. You got a whole array. But the underlying theme that came out of it was the critical factor is effectiveness that we can define. So as we begin to raise levels of effectiveness, problems and issues, racism, bias, sexism, you name it, they begin to subside. They never go away. This is very powerful. So what that means is, and I'm jumping a lot of steps, as we go to address any situation, and this doesn't have to be one where there are racial issues, we've got to understand we have a two-handed approach for addressing these issues. A two-handed approach. What does that mean? Well, the first hand is that of activism, where we have to problem solve, we have to correct situations. So if we go to the civil rights movement, and it's not just there that this has been exhibited, we have the extraordinary civil rights movement, Dr. Martin Luther King, Reverend Vernon Johns, on and on and on. They represented extraordinary activism, bringing out Brown versus the Board of Education, 1954 Supreme Court decision. Extraordinary activism. But the point is, that alone is not enough, because all we're doing is addressing the problems. Not that it is important, that's to keep up. But we need to understand what the second hand. The second hand is, because we understand the role of effectiveness, because we can define it, we can implement it as scientists, we can begin to elevate it. And as we do that, we begin to reduce problems and issues. So as we begin to train teachers, I spent 2 years in Washington State, from Tacoma to Wilson Creek and all around, my colleague and I, Patricia Benavides, training teachers to work more effectively with diverse students. The most critical factor was we increased their level of effectiveness in working with minority students, students from different cultural backgrounds, men, women, what have you. We increased their level of effectiveness. Up went the achievement, down went the problems and issues. All right. Now, so the second part is building with effectiveness. Now, here's the other thing that happens. It's very subtle. When we have low levels of effectiveness, not only are minorities and women and black, what have you, as a part of minorities, affected, but to varying degrees, every student to varying degrees is affected. That means white students. That means white students in advanced educational opportunities like advanced placement courses. They have to be reexamined if we talk about the criterion of effectiveness. So as we follow a twofold approach where we're trying to address problems and issues by bringing in analyses of effectiveness, one, and that we're using effectiveness to build, not only are we benefiting those students who have been kind of excluded or a part of the educational process, we actually end up enhancing the quality of education for everybody. That's a very subtle point, but a very powerful point. Because when these kinds of activities in terms of dealing with minorities and women, what have you, they say, oh, here we go. Stop watering down the curriculum. Here we go. We're going to lower the standards. That's what they were claiming we were doing in Washington State to help the black kids, the Native Americans, the Hispanic. Lo and behold, after we put the teachers through all the training that they said they never got in their top teacher training programs, we found that there was increased achievement for all of the students, not just the Native American students, not just the Hispanic students, not just the black students, the poor rural white that they would shovel over into that corner of disadvantage, but for everybody. I know I'm rambling because the time is a factor, but I want to get some points in here. And that what we're after is saying we got a twofold approach in terms of effectiveness that can be the platform for the leaders in building a unifying ideology, a set of programs to begin to address these issues. So I'm speaking very broadly, but there's a lot of data along the way that we've used to support that kind of perspective. And you are a very patient interviewer. I mean, usually interviewers are trying to show that they're interviewers and they have to take over the interaction, but both of you are very patient. And
there's a lot of great ideas that come out. I actually like the graphics. I wish our listeners could see this, but I'm actually teaching myself how to visualize it, put these things down into graphics, because it gives you that sense of structure of where you're going.
Yeah, exactly. See, now what this really is, as an applied scientist, I work in images.
Yeah.
So these are all images.
Right.
My daughter, who's a graphic designer, was able to translate my images and related narrative into this whole picture, which unfolds at YouTube. If you look up Dr. George Banks YouTube, Fulfilling the Strength of Black America, you'll have free access to take a look at all of this. But it's powerful. But this is a systems representation here.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Right.
So here we have the key elements. And then we can begin to talk about the processes that we bring into these key elements, and then the outcomes are after.
So I've got a couple of very interesting questions, I think, that I would like answered. Maybe you can do this. For one thing, I have been involved with some producers of a very interesting film, and it's called From Selma to Stonewall. Mm. And I know some of the producers of it. And Gilbert Caldwell is the executive producer and the host of the film. It's quite good. I went to a screening of it, but it was made 2 years ago. And it compares the civil rights movement and the same-sex rights movement through various perspectives. I'm saying that because if we look back to King's time, and I grew up in Atlanta where Martin Luther King was, I also lived in San Francisco when Harvey Milk was shot, and he was the first gay city councilman. So it was kind of strange at the time, because 10 years after King was shot, this gay rights leader was shot, and it's a similar kind of thing. But that aside, there was such turbulence in the 60s, and we've had turbulence since, and we certainly have turbulence now. And back to some of your talk about systems. This is going to relate together in just a moment. I've read and you were talking about science, so we're on parallel thought process tracks. There is a great book, I'll send it to you, the name, but it's called Leadership and the New Science. And I think you were at Harvard, and the author, Margaret Wheatley, was at Harvard, but she was talking about how when she was trying to figure out what new forms of leadership do we need in the 80s and 90s when the world is changing so fast? The old forms of leadership aren't working.
Need something.
And she was looking at the new scientists, like the systems talking about. So one of them that I had nothing new about was, like, for example, self-organizing systems, chaos theory, things like that. And she said that, I mean, I find it fascinating because you're talking about getting back into a scientific mode. And she's looking at these new sciences.
We were never in it.
Or maybe so. But what I'm saying is, in a chaotic system that scientists study, chaotic systems, I think everybody knows that a lot of our systems have gone into chaos right now. But she talks about how in those systems, on the edge of the system, way out on the edge, there can be a small consensus or disturbance or new situation, something new is born, a new idea. And that in that chaotic state of the system, there actually are forces that seem to amplify a small voice into a larger and larger voice. It seems like with the Stonewall riots was a small incident, or with Rosa Parks on the bus, a small personal incident. But it caught the imagination of the whole system. So I just wanted to lead you in that direction that maybe you had some thoughts along.
Yeah, I have a lot. I mean, this is my origins. But what you're saying is there can be these occurrences almost like at the edge of the universe, but in terms
it
of...
It is the edge.
You say, wow, what's that? And it pops up, you know, and we say, what happened? And we can look back over the history of civil rights. We can look at the history of the United States and America, and we can look at the incidents that popped up.
Boston Massacre.
Yeah. And all of those incidents. Now, yeah, what I'm tying into is that equipped with our view of science and our foundations and a larger framework that really takes more time for me to lay out for you, but you're getting the gist of it. we can begin to efficiently build with our thinking, our knowledge, our information. We can build. Now, just last night, I was looking at my book by Taylor Branch, historian.
He went to my school in high school.
Taylor Branch.
He sure did, in Atlanta, Georgia.
And he starts off, and I had to go back to it again, the story of the
parting of the waters?
Yeah. Reverend Vernon Johns.
Yeah, okay, yes, yeah. I remember.
Father of the Civil Rights Movement, preceded Martin Luther King at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church.
Right.
Now, okay. What we have with with him, with a man called William Monroe Trotter out of Boston in the late 1800s and into the 1900s. And my father, whose mentor was William Monroe Trotter, is you have three individuals, Johns, Trotter, and my father, who understood the need to not only be activists, but to build. And that was part of what got Johns in a little difficulty, because everybody saw him going around making all these strong speeches. And they said, well, we need somebody a little more moderate in here, Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. We got this Reverend Martin Luther King, so let's bring him in. Because Johns was a little hard to digest. In fact, his niece, Barbara Johns, in 1951, led the school walkout in Farmville, Virginia, of the R.R. Moton School protesting segregation. And everybody got upset. Finally, the NAACP got attention to it, and they came in, and it became one of the four cases that was folded into the 1954 Supreme Court decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. But that was, again, Vernon Johns' disposition for initiative. All right, now, the thing is, I love my history, and I got all of my history books, but here's the thing for me, and I talk with historians about it. There's an assumption, and we see it as prevalent now as ever. If we go back and celebrate the history, appreciate the history, oh my goodness, in 2 days, we are celebrating, we've been leading up to it, D-Day, extraordinary for the United States of America. Brings tears to your eyes as I watch it. Unbelievable. And the point for me is this. We have to understand how to take the lessons that all of these extraordinary people provided us through their sacrifice, their lives, black, white, what have you. We've got to take these lessons and understand how to implement them, because I go back to social psychology. And the idea was, if we make people aware of racism and this and that, things will happen. No, they won't. You got to do more than just make them aware. You've got to teach them how to do, how to relate, how to teach. It's just like, I don't know if you're involved in sports, but I've coached my daughter's basketball teams. And they'd come out, and we'd have our practice. I didn't just sit there and talk about basketball and how they should be polite and not foul so they can stay in the whole game, and how they'd be successful as nice young ladies. I taught them how to play fast break, person-to-person defense, and we were very successful. But I taught them how to do it, and I just didn't talk to them, as any teacher would do, as any coach would do. So the point is, we've got to build on these wonderful stories in honor of those portrayed in those stories. We've got to say, how do we build on those sacrifices? How do we build on those contributions? This kind of platform that I am talking about is a way to do that. Not just for black Americans, for all Americans, because we are at that edge now in terms of, we're at that threshold. How do we advance in terms of freedom for the United States of America to varying degrees involving everybody, not just those involved in slavery, been enslaved, been a part of the slavery, part of slavery, but for countless numbers of people, contributions. Anyway, I know I'm rambling.
And I think this is wonderful. Do you want to? I don't want
to. As we get to the last 20 minutes of the show, I do have some comments, and I believe also John has some things that he wants to say. I do want to say before I make my own personal final comments or questions, I am just curious if you could briefly touch on, and now that we're discussing a little bit about sports and the racial divide today in the United States and the struggles going on with that, with Colin Kaepernick and all the publicity he created, in addition to the protests going on with the with the methods that the police are using. I know that they are starting to have body cameras, which I do think are a good thing that is helping to reduce unnecessary violence coming from police. I do personally want to see some change, but I do feel that we are progressing. But I wanted to get your if you could touch on that, your thoughts.
Okay, that's an awful lot there, and I can see the major concern that you have, because these are very critical social issues in our communities or what have you. Let me give you this perspective. I read an article in the sports section of the Washington Post, and I forgot the writer's name, but she was reporting on a little conference they had in D.C. I guess it was last weekend, not this past weekend, where athletes were coming together, primarily African-American athletes, in terms of continuing the activism and moving ahead and taking on that responsibility. So I sent an email, and my email referenced my work from Fulfilling the Strength of Black America, Indeed All America, my twofold approach. I said, look, the original model for activism in this area was Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson was my hero. Now, the principles of Jackie Robinson, in terms of leadership, what have you, I saw articulated through the Boston Celtics with Red Auerbach and Bill Russell. And my wife says, oh, God, tell him to be quiet because he'll just run up the rest of your time here. And I consider it the greatest expression of a human endeavor in the sports era. Anyway, that's off. But let's just come back to what I sent. And I said, look, the athletes know, those who are in attendance, please pass this on along to them. Their success has come about in their sports arena from a two-handed approach. If they were on track, they didn't run with just one hand, with the other hand kind of tied to their hip. Or if they're playing golf, it was all two-handed. And what they have to understand is that this is a challenge with all of these issues in terms of civil rights and what have you, requires a two-handed approach where you continue to raise issues about these situations, okay? But you also look at what goes into building. Now, let me talk just quickly about law enforcement, because I got to streamline this. In the 1970s, my colleagues, four of us men, two black and two white, there might have been a few more, we went into Dallas, Texas, and we went to work with a Dallas, Texas police department. And we were there to help them with issues they were having with juvenile offenders and what have you, and their racial overtones. And there were two of us were black, two of us were white. And they saw us coming in and looking at us like, well, what are these guys going to really teach us? Maybe they're just going to preach to us about equal opportunity and things like that. But what we did, we took the skills that we had learned, that we had taught the prison guards, that we taught the teachers, we taught the parents, teachers, go on and on. We taught them skills for how to relate to to offenders. Not to go soft on them, not to go belly up on them, not to let them get away with anything, but how to begin to relate to them, relate to them interpersonally. And that's a whole array of skills that we could get into. But yeah. But they're there. And as I mentioned, Dr. Robert Karkov, he has developed further than anyone else this whole platform. But we train.
But that was for relating.
No. Much more than that. I'm just giving you relating as an example.
Yeah, okay.
So I'm sorry because I keep cutting it short because I know we're running out of time.
Yeah, sure.
But so we went in and we started giving them the skills, and they're looking at us like, you know, what are these guys giving us this wimpy stuff to do with these kids? They don't know what these kids are like. They're bad. They're mean. But there was a little test of adolescence. So it was their will against our will. So we went through it, and we trained them, and we got them to begin to try out the skills, absorb the skills. And that was like over a couple of weeks. And then they went out into the field, and they began to use the skills in the neighborhoods with the juvenile offenders. And I'm making it real quick right now. But we began to do a follow-up assistance and assessment and evaluation. And there was a reduction in the recidivism rate to crime in those neighborhoods down to 7-8%. Let that sink in now. Because the officers were taught how to relate to the offenders in a proactive way. Not to let them off the hook. And it reminds me growing up in Roxbury, Massachusetts, where my buddy said, hey, wait a minute, 7 o'clock at night, someone's gonna come along, I want you to meet. Well, we're by our park. About 7:15, along comes a police officer, a white police officer, and we're black. He said, hey, how you guys doing? We're doing fine. We chatted for a few minutes, and he went on. The next 5 days, we looked for him. We were looking for him to come back. I guess he got reassigned. But I'm trying to tell you, it's not that simple, but it's that effect that you begin, and part of building effectiveness, coming to the leadership to begin to pass on these kinds of platforms and programs to law enforcement as well as to education. We've got data that demonstrates all of that. So I know it's quick, but we've got a way to handle these things, but we've got to get people together and say, look, we want to try a way to move ahead where we take responsibility, we take the leadership for thinking these things through, knowing the platforms available. And I apologize because I'm feeling very incomplete and very abrupt and what have you. So that's one piece.
I think the important thing is that you've shared some of your thoughts, obviously not a large percentage, but the manner of your thinking and the manner of your trying to make these changes. I'm very interested in systems and discovering. This is the same thing. There's a nonprofit here called Ashoka.org. I don't know if you've heard of it, but they promote social entrepreneurship. But the gentleman that founded it is, I think, in his 70s now, and he is Bill Drayton, went to your school, Harvard. But he was going to be a lawyer, but he says, I'm not so interested in arguments and conflicts as lawyers engage in, as I like to build things. And I think that's really important.
People.
Yes.
And that's all a system is a representation of something that is being built by people and implemented by people.
Right.
And a system is just a way of organizing it and helping to see how it's progressing and making changes and what have you.
Right.
And I think sometimes that people element and the critical contribution they make in terms of their thinking and information processing gets overlooked under the system piece.
Say that again, please. I'm really interested.
I'm just saying what gets overlooked is the critical contribution of the human being in their thinking process within the organization, within the system, that gets lost. And then you have the technology overlay, which in many instances ends up drowning out even further or diminishing even further that human capacity. Now, equipping them, training them, teaching them, and this has to be done on scale, small scale to large scale, you actually begin to bring out that human capacity.
You know, you said something, people feel lost or they get drowned. Those are two phrases you just used. I think those are two very important phrases because it's about feeling overwhelmed, by either the system itself, which is out of control, or the crashing system that's crashing around you.
But we can equip them to navigate individually, collectively, and with leadership to build. But that takes re-examinations.
Well, that's, as a social worker, I'm working with those two, how to reform. That's why some of these chaos theory lectures that I'm listening to are interesting. When things break down, it is an opportunity for new growth, like when the forest burns down.
It is an opportunity.
Yeah.
We have tremendous opportunity right now.
Right.
To take advantage of it.
Right.
Now back to the lead question that Javier had that I didn't have a chance to get into. He talked about work in Boston. It was actually in Springfield, Massachusetts. We're under the leadership of Dr. Robert Carcuff, Dr. Andrew Griffin. We actually created what was called the Springfield Miracle. And we went into primarily the African-American community, and we began to build with the individuals in there, the families, the unemployed folks, got them employed, taught them skills in terms of relating and helping. It's a long story. You'll see a snippet of it in my infographic, my book.
In Springfield.
Springfield, Massachusetts. Okay. Springfield, Miracle.
Where basketball was invented.
John Naismith, been there. But what I'm saying is it's a demonstration of what you can do to build with the people within the, quote, community system, which involves integrating what you're building within the schools. We worked with the schools, the teachers, the community action programs, and we reduced unemployment significantly, and we had people gainfully employed over 25 years after the project. And I'd have to send you more on it because I'm really rushing and skipping steps.
Sure.
But what I'm saying, and I wouldn't be here, as I said at the start, talking with you guys and talking with your wonderful audience, if I didn't believe we have a direction. We have a way to go. Now, thinking it through and working it through, yes, but we have a direction.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. Thank you, Xavier, for arranging this whole thing and hosting it. I have been working with some of the civil rights leaders and same-sex rights leaders because of this film that was created. And I think that this is the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riot. Again, this is one of these small events that has a huge impact later because it sets in motion all sorts of imagination for change, I guess you might say.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But the challenge is how to build that in. I'm working with civil rights leaders right now, okay?
And building it in.
No,
yeah.
Okay. Not necessarily.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Because they don't, this is not a criticism. But they've got to understand the potential to use that second hand for building. Because we don't always have clear illustrations in the society as to how we build for anybody. Now, I'm not knocking it. I'm not being anti-critical.
I think that's a brilliant point.
I'm not being critical.
I'm really interested in what you just said.
We go out to the rural areas. There are a lot of instances where just poor whites have been treated in a certain way. It's not just African-American. To varying degrees, we've all been struggling with this freedom issue and this growth issue. So the point I'm making is, as I watch all these wonderful pieces of art and work in terms of African-American history and the difficulties, I just had the quick flash on the way over here about the Denzel Washington and the work they did at T.C. Williams High School, the story that they portrayed there in terms of integrating at T.C. Williams High School, all these wonderful stories. But the point is, we've got to use these as lessons with which we can build for fear that all of that effort put out, the contributions, the sacrifices, will not be fully valued and taken advantage of. But the point is, I say all that because we've got the capacity to do it. I and the folks I'm working with, that is our intent. And we're looking for people who are looking to take the initiative in terms of leadership, as I'm laying it out here. Not that they have to follow it the way we do it, but just in terms of the critical ingredients, we have a lot of potential. That's all.
Okay, and I guess one last question and then closing remarks from John.
Well, I think that this is something that I'm working with in my training as a social worker, is to give people a structure or teach them how to build into their lives a new structure that has that framework that they can follow, in which they say this a lot about leadership, that you're trying to give your followers an environment that will help them develop their skills and increase effectiveness, as you said. That's what we're looking for. We want to have a higher impact. Yeah. And I think that the building ideas is one of the top things I'll take away from this, because I think that's where we have to rebuild, because the systems are crashing and we have to rebuild.
We have to rebuild. But the thing is, I'd raise the question to the extent to which the systems were about building. Yes, they did some building, but in terms of the capacity, the potential to build, we've got a long way to go. That's all. And I'm not condemning what happened in the past and all
but
of the wonderful work.
Learning to build.
Yes, learning to build on what we've accomplished so far.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Hey, this is tough to cover in a brief period of time. Relatively brief.
It gives us some ideas.
You guys are fantastic.
Thank you.
I think we might be able to extend this a little more. I will have to stop this episode at the end of 1 hour. We're down to the last about 4 minutes.
I have to get going.
Okay. So we have about 4 minutes for any final remarks.
I think I remarked all over the place, so I just say,
just wrap it up.
It's just wonderful to work with you all. And your openness, your thinking, I find it to be very positive, very supportive, very building. And I really appreciate having the opportunity to sit here and share so much with you and get your response. So I thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And also because I do have some plans for some other events or radio shows where we have a set of people together trying to use new ways of interacting that bring in a multiplicity of voices, but we'll certainly keep you apprised of that. George Mason is, I think, the most innovative, voted the most entrepreneurial, innovative university in the United States. So that's a great place to be working. So thank you, Dr. Banks.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Dr. Banks. It was a pleasure interviewing you today, and we look forward to staying in touch and maybe possibly doing another episode in the future.
Great. Thank you all very much.